Time for another edition of Garden Talk, and on this Arbor Day, we are going to focus on trees. Larry Mueller here with my guest, back again, one of our regular guests, Bruce Allison, professional arborist and author of some books. He's got the latest, If a Tree Could Talk, from Wisconsin Historical Society Press. He's also the author of Every Root an Anchor, second edition, and of Wisconsin's Champion Trees, and he's been with us many times to talk about trees, and really pleased to have him with us today. And certainly, you may join in with your questions or comments as we move along here today. If you have questions about trees, I hope you'll join us. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Bruce, welcome back.
Larry, it's great to be back, and happy Arbor Day to you.
Happy Arbor Day to you. You gave me a big surprise today.
Well, I did, Larry, and if you don't mind, I'll take just a couple seconds of your viewers' time, mm-hmm. Your listeners' time, to present an award to you, and this is a very special award. Last year, the University of Wisconsin Foundation established an endowment fund called the Wisconsin Tree Legacy Fund, which focuses on landscape trees and their contributions to the human landscape. Every year, they will be presenting an award to those people who have made a special impact in Wisconsin on the preservation, research, education regarding our trees, our landscape trees in the state. It's called the Joyce Kilmer Award, and people will remember that Joyce Kilmer was the author of a poem that was published in 1913 that swept across the country. Kids for many generations were forced to recite this early on and memorize it. Trees by Joyce Kilmer, only God can make a tree. Poems are made by fools like me. It's a poem that still rings so true as we recognize with the change in environment, global warming, the importance and impact that trees will have in leading us out of the problems that we have right now. So this is called the Joyce Kilmer Award, and there is a strong Wisconsin connection. Joyce Kilmer, in 1917, came to Wisconsin to do the graduation speech at the Campion Catholic Seminary in Prairie du Chien. He said that after I returned from the First World War, he was a doughboy over there, I will come back to Wisconsin. I love the trees here. I love the environment here. I love the people. This is where I want to spend the rest of my life. Sadly, he was not able to fulfill that promise. He died fighting in France. He was buried in Flanders Field. And however, his poem lives on. His story and connection to Wisconsin is very strong. And so I present to you a piece of wood from the oak tree that inspired Joyce Kilmer to write the poem Trees. This comes from the Rutgers University campus. It was a tree that came down in 1963, began growing in 1766.
Amazing.
And it was brought to Wisconsin by a graduate student who was doing work at Rutgers, but had come originally from Wisconsin, a student of Walter Rowlands, who was a professor in agronomy. And Walter Rowlands was a great woodworker. And at the request of President E.B. Fred, he cut it into some pieces. There are very few pieces. I came across it when the widow of Walter Rowlands knew of the work I had done with trees and writing about trees and talked about Joyce Kilmer, and she found this piece of wood. And it's carved into the shape of an acorn and presented to you, the first recipient of the Wisconsin Tree Legacy Fund annual Joyce Kilmer Award. And Larry, thank you for all you do for Wisconsin's trees.
Well, thank you so very much, Bruce. I hardly know what to say. I really appreciate this. The acorn is it's really great, and to know that it came from that tree is that is really, really special. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And we have lots to be thankful for, I think, with our trees here in the state. We've got some wonderful trees, and you've written your books, your latest now, If Trees Could Talk. Talk about that book, because this is a book that's, well, frankly, any of us are going to enjoy this book, but you sort of aimed it at a younger audience.
Well, I'm delighted that the Wisconsin Historical Society Press published 3 years ago Every Root an Anchor, which is the Wisconsin's famous and historic trees the stories told, Civil War trees, connection with all the Leopold, the remarkable size trees, Indian trail marker trees. It's all of the stories that the people throughout the state had been sending to me for years and to other people before, and I gathered it together and put it into book form so it's available. And they had the wonderful idea of not just making an adult book, but reaching the children, those people that are going to be the greatest beneficiaries of all the things we do for trees and planting of new trees. And they've done a beautiful job, I think, in gathering appropriate stories. They actually interviewed a variety of elementary school children to ask which stories they thought would be most exciting, which was pretty interesting for me to see which ones really...
which ones they picked.
Well, exactly. The haunted trees of Merrill and some of the strange, scary trees that we talk about, Burles and the Horicon Marsh area. So there's throughout the state, and they've actually... put in here a map of where the remaining live trees are so that people might actually go to visit some of these famous and historic trees. And they gathered some news stories. We talk a little bit about one of the Alda Leopold stories. Nina Leopold was able to tell the story of how her father, Aldo, encouraged them to plant trees, and they literally had to have a bucket brigade of buckets of water to be able to keep the young pine trees growing. But indeed, now, you know, many years later, there they are. So some wonderful stories, and it's nicely presented, some very nice pictures, aimed at the fourth grade level. It's part of what they call the Badger Series, which is the State Historical Society attempt to encourage young people to appreciate the history of the land in which they live.
Well, it's great, and it's available. Oh, it's University of Wisconsin.
It's Wisconsin Historical Society Press.
Yes.
And if one goes on the internet to Wisconsin Historical Society Press, .org or something to that effect, they'll be able to purchase it there. Bookstores throughout the state are also carrying it.
Well, it's a great book, and it's going to be a lot of fun. I know readers for – and a lot of schools are actually getting copies of this for use in their classroom.
Absolutely. It's become a teaching tool for many of the children.
Bruce Allison, our guest today, as we talk with him about trees and shrubs, if you have a question for him, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. Somebody asked me the other, not too long ago, about pruning oaks, and I'm wondering if it's too late to prune oaks this time of year, and I'm pretty sure I know how you respond, but go ahead.
The answer is yes, it's too late, and people should pay a little bit of attention because the Department of Natural Resources did a lot of additional research on this, and as our climate changing, that is the period of cold during the winter and the amount of degree days is increasing, we have the planting areas moving further north, and of course that affects not only the plant growth but also all of those diseases and insects that are associated with those individual hosts. And so now we have changed, at least in southern Wisconsin, from a cutoff period of April 15th to now April 1. And so all oak pruning in those southern counties should stop by April 1. In the northern counties, usually, you know, north of Stevens Point and beyond, one can still go until April 15th, but paying attention to individual variations by year. If it's warming up and you start to see any kind of bud swell. The problem with the oaks, of course, is this fungus called oak wilt, which can enter the tree through freshly made wounds. And so that's why one wants to be very cautious during that period, especially from leaf bud break to full leaf development. And we have a greater comfort that later in the summer one can return to pruning safely and certainly return to logging where you don't have a lot of very small wounds. And there are new guidelines that I encourage both those people that are logging within a forest production setting, but also those that are doing commercial pruning as arborists and homeowners who choose to prune their own oak trees should go visit and revisit because things have changed somewhat.
All right. Well, all of our lines are filled, so let's go to the phones and John in Berlin up first. Hi, John. Thanks a lot for calling.
Yes, I have a question. I've got two large trees in my front yard. They're ash trees, and they're maybe 40 feet tall, and they're getting too overpowering. I'm afraid an ice storm will take a limb down on top of the house in the middle of the winter, and I'm thinking either taking them out and putting new trees in, or can I take an ash tree that's, you know, 40 years old or 45 years old and just cut it in the middle halfway up to trim it?
There's a lot of information I have for you regarding that particular situation. No, you may not successfully just top a big tree like that. The reason for that is that the growth points of a tree in terms of the crown are at the buds, which are distributed at the ends and along lateral branches within the crown of the tree. So if you were just to top it off, you have taken away all those areas that are going to be opening up the leaves and having carbohydrate production. Plus, you have then forced the tree to send out what are known as adventitious shoots, those shoots that come from embedded buds that only open up after a traumatic event has occurred on that tree. Those are poorly attached. They might make the tree survive for a while, so you see many topped trees. It used to be very common practice. And you don't really accomplish very much in terms of the safety, which sounds like it's your main concern, because of those branches being poorly attached. They have a significantly increased probability of breaking off and falling on the house. Plus, you're left with a tree that is just a shadow of its former self in terms of its shape and beauty. It would be highly advised not to do that. In fact, some municipalities have now passed ordinances against tree topping. The whole issue...
Pardon? Should I just cut that one that may perhaps would be the most dangerous?
Yes, that's the strategy. If you're concerned about any individual branch that overhangs a house that would be catastrophic if it failed, you should be aware, number one, of trees have a tremendous ability to resist gravitational forces and hold themselves up. Trees have evolved over a long time. There is a great deal of structural integrity built into trees. However, that can change if you have had decay, if you've had a crack that might have occurred from an earlier windstorm or something that would have changed the mechanical structural situation of that tree. So you should have a competent arborist or somebody who really understands tree structure and what makes trees stand up and trees fall down. Take a look at that and determine if there is a hazardous situation that exists. I would encourage you to do that, and they might be able to, put your concerns to rest. There are many huge limbs overhanging buildings that stay that way for decades and don't fail. The vast majority of trees do not fail. But if you're concerned about a single branch and just don't want to take any chance, then yes, cutting out an individual branch, properly pruning it back to the main trunk, and leaving that branch bark collar, that cluster of cells that is at the intersection of the main trunk to that branch going out, will allow quick closure, especially in an ash. They're fairly competent at dealing with decay. Mm-hmm. The other problem, of course, and just because you presented ash, and other people might be worried about this too, and you've certainly heard it not only in the newspapers, but on public radio and elsewhere, there is a problem called emerald ash borer, which is an insect which has moved in and is threatening the well-being of our ash. We haven't quite worked through successful defense mechanisms. There is an insecticide or two that could be used to protect certain trees, but with ash, we're encouraging no additional planting of ash trees, and we'll just have to work our way through this. So if for some reason you discovered that you had emerald ash borer nearby, didn't want to go to the expense of protecting this tree with the chemical treatment, then you would feel more comfortable taking it down and moving on with a different species. But I discourage the planting of ash trees.
Right.
Okay.
Thanks, right. John. Hope that's been of some help.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Dave in Melrose has a question for you. Bruce?
Hello.
Hi, Dave.
How you doing?
Good. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
I'm looking for a way to keep the deer off my apple trees.
Yeah. Boy, good luck. Boy, I'll tell you, Dave, I live on a farm in Verona just south of Madison, and we have probably, 60 to 80 acres of apple trees. And, particularly if you've got a newer orchard, you've got the smaller variety, on 7 or 8 rootstock. They're going to be the semi-dwarfs, and so it's much easier for those deer to go there. And especially when you've had such a heavy snow cover like we did in the early part of the year, those deer start browsing everywhere, and they just love to nip on the ends of those trees. Fencing, of course, is one way to accomplish it, and some of the orchardists that I know have, gone to the expense of putting up big fences. That's fine if you have a commercial orchard to justify that additional cost, but somewhat more problematic for an individual just trying to maintain, a small orchard for their own personal use. Electric fencing is another way, particularly if you can figure out some way to have just, single-strand electric fence that is tied into a solar panel, so you don't have a lot of, additional maintenance cost on it. One little trick is to put some little tapes on there so that, it's easily seen by the deer coming in, particularly blue tapes. Blue is one of those colors which the deer can see very clearly. And then you might want to, when it's it's on and working, put a little bit of peanut butter on there. So a couple of the deer that are more problematic go after that peanut butter, and they put their mouth on that electric wire, and then they're very aware that it's there. So, and there are certainly other, chemical deterrents that people have tried. And, I know that, the University of Wisconsin Extension, the Forest and Wildlife Ecology, actually has a bulletin on deterring deer from crops, and you might want to take a quick look at that. I think that Dr. Scott Craven is the author of that one, and he, I think, has reviewed some of the different chemicals that are used, these deer deterrents. I know that at the Arboretum they have tried dung from the Vilas Zoo, which is right there in Madison, of lions.
Lion and, dung, yeah.
And other things. So, there's a variety of things. Some people have gone to a barber shop and gotten hair, human hair, and put there because, deer are very sensitive to smells. And if they don't recognize familiar smells, they might move away. But those are the thoughts that I have. And if you come up with a better answer, Dave,
let us
email
know.
Me.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks a lot for calling. Bruce Allison, professional arborist, our guest on this Arbor Day on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking trees on this edition of Garden Talk, Larry Mueller here with my guest Bruce Allison, Jim Packard, our producer today, answering the phones and talking with you as you phone us. And that number, by the way, is 1-800-642-1234, or you can also email at talk@wpr.org. Joanne in Fitchburg has a question for you, Bruce, so let's go to Joanne. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah. I have two questions. Can you name some trees to be planted on the south side of the house lawn? Gets 8-9 hours of sun, and one on the north side. And also, do you know any mulch which can repel the rabbits?
Well, answer the first question, last question first. I'm not aware of any mulch that would repel rabbits, but again, there are some chemicals that you might be able to put out there that repel rabbits. It used to be that people would use mothballs that worked pretty well. That's when Napa was put in there, but it turns out that Napa was just a little too toxic for proximity to people, so that was no longer done, and I think the newer varieties don't have that same repellent quality. But do visit some of the websites of garden catalogs. Gempler's is one out of Janesville. There, Wisconsin one. If you take a look at Young's and Johansson and the Bruce Company, and there's a variety of others that I'm,
sure.
too long. Just visit those and see if there are some repellents, and then ask people that work there if they've really had success with those in repelling rabbits. But it's a tough one to repel rabbits also. There are certain plants that you can put in that I know I've heard from people, some of the flowers, whether it's nasturtium or mm-hmm. something like that, tend to be pretty effective at keeping the rabbits away, so you might want to try that also. In terms of planting, well, the south side's easy because the south side is where all that sun is, and of course, trees are great solar collectors. They're looking for all of that. If you're in Fitchburg, you've got some, you know, pretty good soils there that, you know, is a fairly, flat, probably well glaciated and somewhat alluvial soils there also. So you've got some good options fairly deep. I always like planting oaks. You know, people are so afraid. We talk about oak wilt all the time. Yeah. But in point of fact, you know, 90% of the oak wilt infections occur through root grafts as opposed to fresh wounds. So if you plant red oaks, which are the ones that are most probable to die from oak wilt, you know, far enough apart, you don't have that probability of oak wilt. Or if you just have one or two in your yard, it's not a huge issue as if you were planting them row after row like we did with the Dutch elm, with the American elm trees. So I like oaks. I think a red oak is a fairly fast-growing one. I'd avoid the pin oak unless you've checked the soil pH of your soil. It's very dependent upon acidity in the soil and will turn yellow if you've got anything that is above like about a 6.3 or 6.5 pH, which means it's getting more alkaline. But like the swamp white oak, I like the cross between the burr and the swamp white, which is the shutai oak. It's a naturally occurring cross, grows quite well. I planted 200 of those on my farm, and they're all doing well, 100% to success
wow.
rate, which is pretty unusual. But if you, you know, plant them well, if you go away from the oaks, take a look at some of the maples. Avoid Norway maples, but the red maples do well. And the red maple, it's a little confusing because the red maple is a native tree. It's the Acer rubra, which is red, as opposed to the Norway red maple, like the Schweidler or the Crimson King. I don't like those nearly as much, but the native one. And they would do well on the north side, so I'd be thinking about red maples on the north side. I think that would be a good choice there. Back on the south side, I like the little leaf linden. Very nice one. It's the Tilia cordata, and that's just the scientific name. Tilia just is the genus of the basswood and the linden trees, and cordata is the name that's given because it's, you know, cardiology, heart-shaped leaf. I think it's a lovely tree.
It's a pretty tree.
And very dense and will, you know, get to a reasonable size, easy to maintain, grows well and fairly quickly. So those are some ideas. You know, the paper birch is great to be a little sensitive on the south side. I'd rather have it on the north side where it doesn't get as much direct sunlight. Some of the smaller ones that are really nice are the serviceberry that's very nice shape to it, very attractive. Some of the alders would be interesting. Again, they're smaller trees. So you've got a pretty good palette, and you might want to visit, again, the UW Learning Center, I think it's called, the website, and Dr. Laura Jahl's done a very nice job in putting together a list of trees that are alternatives to the ash trees for planting. And so you've got some good choices there. And I would take a careful look at that and see how the ultimate size would fit in with the location that you have.
All right. Good luck. Thank you very much, Joanne, for calling. Appreciate it. We have an email from Valerie in Burnhamwood. She and her husband were given 200 yearling trees a couple of years ago from a friend, and it was maple, plum, oak, black walnut. Anyway, they had to plant or just sort of stick them in the ground until they could figure out where to plant them, and they now have figured that out, but they've lost, for one reason or another, only about 60 of them have survived. So they now want to transplant the trees. Valerie says, my husband is thinking that he may be able to bare root the trees and replant them, but I'm thinking that we will need to dig a large circle around each of them to get the soil and all the roots with them. How far down do you think we will have to dig? And what kind of reaction do you expect? Might we expect from these trees?
Well, good questions, because planting is very critical to do it properly. And if you think about it, these trees evolved over the millennia, not with people planting them. I mean, maybe they had squirrels planting the seeds. But so it's a rather unusual situation for them, if you take a look at their natural history, to have somebody dig it up and move it over someplace else. So we have to make sure that we do it the right way. When you, if you do choose to dig it up with some soil with it, and of course that's probably the best way to make sure that you have the maximum number of roots moving with it, and that's the important statistic to be concerned about, is the root to crown ratio, because no matter what, even if you pull them up bare root or take some soil, you'll be leaving something behind. So to get
these
as much,
are about a couple feet tall,
fairly small, yeah, which is good. So you can simply, you know, take the soil with it, dig the hole in advance, make it a very quick process so you don't have much chance for desiccation or drying out, and make sure that they get planted in that hole at the same depth that they existed growing in the earlier soil, so that you don't end up getting them too deep in the soil. That's been a huge problem for people, getting the plants too deep. And be aware that when you dig that hole, if you try to soften up the soil underneath, thinking, well, it's easier for the roots to go down there, what you're ending up doing is disturbing the soil so that it's going to drop or sink down further. And so that is not what you want to have. It might look fine when you leave, but as it settles down after you get the water in there, the disturbed soil underneath will compact. So you want to leave the soil, the bottom of your planting hole undisturbed. Could you do it bare root? Well, you know, sure. That's very typically done in the nursery setting. They have an early digging period to create what they call lining out stock. So they'll take the smaller plants and they'll pull them up, shake the soil off, and then sell them bare root. The key there also is they move very quickly. They keep them in a holding area where there's plenty of moisture so you don't have the desiccation or drying out of those fine root hairs. And then they put them in the new setting, and they call it lining out because usually it's other nurseries that buy from them, and they line them out to grow another couple years before then they dig them up, bald and burlap, and move them out to other sites or sell them. So small trees like that, yes, you could very successfully do bald and burlap. If you wanted to go to the extra effort to take some soil with, then do so. But make sure, especially if you have kind of, you know, sandy or friable, very friable soil, that you know, have some sort of a, you know, the plastic bags underneath or burlap or cardboard or something, so that the soil doesn't all fall apart on the way over to the new site. And then, of course, once you've got them planted, maintaining adequate moisture is really important. Not flooding, but maintaining adequate moisture.
All right. Let's go to Phil in Wanakee. On to you now. Hi, Phil.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What can we do for you?
I have two questions. One is, years ago, my father and I went up to Trempolo, and we picked up nuts from the American chestnuts, and we started growing them on the farm down in Grand County near the river, and they've done real well. We've got lots of trees that are producing nuts like crazy, and we pick them every year and replant them. I was just wondering if there's any other places in the state of Wisconsin that have good groves of them going. And my second question is, we brought yellow poplars or tulip trees back from Tennessee years ago, and we've got them planted around. In fact, I got one here in my front yard in Wanakee. And I'm afraid because some of the ones we planted on our farm have developed a big split on the main trunk. And somebody told me that's because they're not used to the harsh winters. And I was wondering, do you know anything or can you give me any ideas about protecting those types of trees that we've got? Because one in my front yard in Wanakee is, you know, 35, 40 foot tall now, and it has not, does not have a split, but I'm
worried about it.
Worried that it would.
Okay.
You bet, Phil. Phil, that's wonderful that you're, you know, finding American chestnut seed and planting them. The American chestnut, of course, used to be a very important species in the north central, primarily east central and northern eastern areas. It was a very important forestry crop. Unfortunately, in the early part of the 1900s, there developed a chestnut blight that was a topical fungus and associated virus that created wounds or ulcerations on the bark that inhibited the movement of the water and nutrients throughout the tree and caused a huge decline in the chestnuts. We didn't have that as a problem here for many, many years because we were really out of their natural zone of the true American chestnut, which is Castanea dentata, not to be confused with the buck, Ohio buckeye, or with the horse chestnut. Unfortunately, that's no longer the case. In those few groves that have been successful, we now are observing that there indeed are infestations of the chestnut blight. So you got to be a little careful not to create too large a single planting, but rather keep some distance between them, and you might be able to reduce the probability of an infection of the chestnut blight. And certainly when you go to visit other groves of chestnuts, be very cautious not to inadvertently become a vector or a transfer of the fungus into your groves. And that's exactly, you know, how it can happen. I mean, birds can do it, but people can also do it. If you go to my book, Every Root and Anchor, we talk about an existing grove of American chestnuts. And let me just look in the children's book, and I'll give you a little detail on that. Yeah, it's the Lund chestnut trees. Well, you went up to Trempealeau, so that's where you went, up to Trempealeau to get the Lund chestnuts in that area.
Mm-hmm.
So they
stopped giving them to us too.
Probably concerned about the chestnut blight, because I think from what I have read,
he does have it now.
The chestnut blight exists there right now. And if you go onto the web, there's some good research that was done by our excellent Department of Natural Resources plant pathologist Jane Cummings Carlson. She got very involved in that and has done just a beautiful job in taking a look at some options out there and giving some guidelines on how to manage the American chestnut. And of course, there's an International Chestnut Association that you might want to just Google and take a look at also because of your interest there. So those are my recommendations. You know, to sort of make yourself fully aware of the potential for the chestnut blight, be very cautious in, you know, where you distribute those chestnuts so as not to make too large a population that could introduce that epidemic in your area. Secondly, with the tulip tree, that's a wonderful tree. It certainly will grow here. It is probably, as our climate zones move a little bit further north, will be even a more prevalent tree. But it would certainly can, during hard winters, develop those sunscald-type cracks on the main trunk. Doesn't have that same good insulation that some of the native trees that have evolved over time in our particular climate zone. But nonetheless, it's one well worth trying to plant. Obviously, the fact that you've got one in your yard that's already, you know, 30-plus feet tall. It is the Luriodendron tulip fura. I love those binomial names like that. It just sort of rolls off your tongue. But it's called the tulip tree, as you well know, because the flower is tulip-like. It's a very beautiful flower that is just remarkable and stands out. And it grows, you know, fairly quickly, can be quite tall. When I first started tree climbing as an apprentice, many, many years ago, for a year with a company in Baltimore, Maryland, we had to climb the tulip poplar trees that were over 100 feet tall, and that was quite a start to a climbing career.
Oh,
but what I would be thinking about is you probably have those cracks most likely on the southern exposure where they're getting extra heat, which then as the tree cools off at night, will promote that cracking going on. Or if they're near masonry, we pick up additional thermal loading, you can also get a problem with cracking there. So be cautious of that. Make sure that it stays vigorous with adequate moisture, especially when you go into the winter. Make sure you have plenty of moisture in the soil, almost to field capacity, full saturation, so that there is no deficiency of moisture. And people, you know, say, well, let's put some, you know, tree wrap around the trunk as much as you can. There's some debate about that. Some of the university people have taken a look at that and don't necessarily think that's really adding much. But it certainly keeps that reflective light off. So consider that perhaps as a possibility for yourself.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. Appreciate it. And Ronald in Door County has a question for you. Hi, Ronald.
Hi. Can you hear me clearly?
Yes, you bet.
Okay. I'm at the tip of Door County. I recently had an addition on a cottage. We're very wooded up here. I have about an acre of ground. Very close to the water. Old Door County cottage. And rather than tear it down, we added onto it to create the same feeling without feeling you're coming up out of the suburbs. Mm-hmm. I got talked in. I had to remove some trees in the addition. Well, a stand of Norway pines, but I also had what appeared to be probably a red oak and maples mixed. And they've grown very tall over the years because I think there was a dense stand at one time. Very sandy soil, of course, and limestone kind of shale up here. Now, what happened, with the addition, I also got talked out of one or two trees that I didn't think needed to come down. Well, I got talked into it, it's my fault. They thought they would fall because they had some root exposure, but I have one tree that's had root exposure for 20 years at the edge of the water line, the high water mark, and it's never fallen. What I did is I lost myself east, or I faced northeast, so that part of the house, which is primarily south and somewhat east, is now casting sun on the cottage a lot. I've talked to some people up here. I have a lot of trees that are very, very small in diameter, like up to 3-4 inches, but they're very tall. They're talking about transplanting, pulling these up and giving me a stand of trees there to start creating a shade. So my question is that a good idea, or do you have a suggestion for trees that grow fast that can provide me some shade here on that side of the house?
Mm-hmm. Well, you've got a few issues there for transplanting. I think growing fast on that side, and your limestone, it's a dolomitic limestone, so it's as opposed to the calcareous limestone that we have further south, it's not going to be raising that pH, and so you don't have those same limitations that you might otherwise for those plants that are more, requiring strictly acid and that don't do well in an alkaline soil. But you do have even though you've got some sandy soil there, you've got, a pretty high, you got that Niagara Escarpment. You got a pretty high shelf there, and so the sand sitting on top of that, and so it's going to be a very droughty situation moving through. But you can enhance the soil by adding a lot of organic matter, just taking, over years the same kind of forest soil duff that would normally occur, and putting that into the soil, mixing it in prior to doing the planting, and that extra moisture, that extra organic matter will make a huge difference in the success of those trees. I would be taking a look at that red maple variety that we were talking about before. The autumn blaze, there's a cross between the silver maple and the Freeman Eye red maple, and it's become quite popular, autumn blaze. There might even be one called autumn applause, and there's some new varieties also that might have even better branching structure that you can choose. So go to your nursery and take a look at those. I don't know that, because of your desire to have it quick growing, somewhat difficult soil site there, now full sun exposure, I don't know that I would just go the route of pulling things out elsewhere and bringing them in, because again, you're going to be set back a little bit by having lost a significant amount of root system in doing so. And you might not have the time to, try and experiment with that. So you might want to get, one-year guaranteed nursery stock, transplanted bald and burlap, try to get size like 3.5-inch caliper. That's usually the standard size. You can get it from a nursery. You can go smaller, down to 2-2.5-inch also. But if, the bigger ones will grow a little bit more quickly, you're well beyond a situation, I think, that a tree spade is going to work particularly well there. And I would discourage it to, even though the tree looks pretty big, you might just create more problems not be able to get the growth that you want, 3 or 4 years from now. But that setting, I think those red maples would be an interesting choice. You could also consider, depending upon what kind of height you're trying to get, some of the birch trees. I know in Door County, because of some droughty situation, you had some big problems with birch leaf miner, and then the bronze birch borer knocked out a tremendous number of those beautiful white birch you had. But you can control for that. That was really a water-related issue. Yes, it was an insect, but it's a ubiquitous insect. You know, it was existing there, and it was only the change in the droughty situation, the extra heat loads that you had, that created the problem. But if you were able to control it with good organic material in the soil and extra watering, you'd probably get some pretty good growth there. And I think that, particularly for your setting with an old cottage near the water, it would make it look very natural and appropriate. Don't also discount the white pines. I prefer the white pine versus the red pine, actually, for longevity and disease resistance. So I would maybe consider some of those also, because they will grow fairly rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not really a shade-related tree, but if you wanted to get some additional growth in there, the arborvitae would grow fairly rapidly. The green or the techne are some of the newer varieties. There are some others also out there that would, you know, maybe further back away from the house, create a nice screen and be able to grow fairly quickly in that kind of setting. But adequate water, proper planting, these will make a huge difference in the success and the growth rate of those trees.
Mm-hmm. And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Bruce Allison, professional arborist, our guest on this wonderful Arbor Day. Here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Larry Mueller. Talking trees with Bruce Allison on this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Joe in Fox Point's been waiting a while, so let's go to Joe. Hi, Joe. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call. You're right. I've been waiting a while. I hope I don't ask something stupid. But I wanted to know how to grow shrubs. Actually, I already have shrubs in the ground, and I have very hard clay soil. And not growing. So I'm wondering, what do I do now that they're in the ground, and in order to get them to get bigger?
What type of shrubs do you have?
Oh, that's a darn good question. I planted some boxwoods. I planted some. Boy, you're really taxing me now. I wasn't ready for that question.
Well, that's no matter, Joe. I mean, your problem is sort of a universal problem in terms of that clay soil. Clay soil is just a little bit more problematic for roots to break out, especially if you bought these with a bald and burlap, where they had nice nursery soils, where obviously the nursery would obviously plant and choose to locate in an area where they could get pretty good growth, so they had, probably a better loam-type soil. They come in that bald and burlap, and you drop them in there, and then those roots, the research shows that they have a hard time breaking out of the soil in which they exist and piercing into a denser soil. They would then tend to stay clustered in that better, more aerated soil. So one of the things you can do, if indeed, say, one of those plants died and you pulled it out, and you might discover that it was like a plant that was in too small a pot. It just had, all of these crossed roots and was not able to break out. So that tells you that you're trapped inside the existing soil, which of course would keep it from growing because it's going to be more limited. They really need to be able to break out and find additional nutrients elsewhere to be able to start growing more successfully. So if indeed that is the case, one of the things you can do is some lateral trenching, and that's done in urban areas all the time where you have the problem of very compacted soils. And so if you imagine where you had your planting hole and where you put your original, ball for those individual shrubs in, from there, like the spokes of a wheel, you can come out in little trenches, and you don't have to go very deep because the vast majority of roots are in that first 6 to 8 inches of soil. Studies of the Morton Arboretum, empirical studies where they've actually dug plants up, I mean, even big trees, they discovered that 90% of the root surface area is in that first 12 inches of soil. So in shrubs, which are smaller, you'll even have more. So suddenly you're creating little avenues for those roots to venture out of the setting in which they find themselves and break through that clay soil. Sometimes even in the digging of the hole in clay soil, you create, with that shovel going down, you create a very hardened area on that clay. It's like taking a clay pot and using your hands to compact it all in or smoothing it out with water. It becomes almost impervious to water and ultimately to roots moving through. So create trenching, maybe make 10 to 12 roots going out, or radial trenches going out. And depending upon the size of the tree, maybe make it twice the diameter of the tree, original tree root ball, and see if that works. In that area, it might be sufficient just to mix up the existing soil in there. If it's really, really an inert type of clay, then I would recommend that you mix some sand and some organic matter in. I mean, take sphagnum peat moss, for example, does a pretty good job. Mix some sand in there, and then you would get closer to a better analysis of soil. Soil scientists take a look at soils as having three components depending upon the size of the particles that it's made of: sand, silt, and clay. Sand being the largest particles, silt being the next, and clay being the smallest. The smaller the particles, the smaller the pores in between, in the space in between, and they can be compressed much closer. So what you want to do is, by adding that sand, increase the tilth of the soil, and adding that organic matter would also make it easier for those individual roots to move through.
And thank you very much for calling. Good luck with your planting there, Joe. Sue in Madison, we give you a chance now. Hi, Sue.
Hi. I wish you would talk about the value of oiling gypsy moss egg masses before the caterpillars hatch out, and it may be very shortly when they will hatch. And anything else that you would like to recommend to people who have gypsy moss have to slow the spread in their yard and area.
All right. Gypsy moth control. We certainly have, this caller's from Madison, and there are certainly plenty of gypsy moths, egg masses in some parts of Madison, as there are in parts all over the state.
Parts all over the state, yeah. And, in that Milwaukee County area, Waukesha, moving through, the southern part of the state all the way to La Crosse, and certainly certain areas up further north also, it's a big problem. Gypsy moths is an invasive insect that has moved in, has already done a lot of work out on the East Coast. So in Pennsylvania, New York, all of New England, Massachusetts, they're very familiar with gypsy moth, and they've moved through, which gives us a little bit of an advantage because we sort of understand better what the control mechanisms are and what we can anticipate happening here. It's moved in, and in some areas we've got a big problem where it's defoliating some very valuable trees. I always think it's so ironic. Gypsy moth can, munch on almost anything. The one that it just absolutely detests happened to be the ash tree. And so there's some biochemistry there. I mean, I've seen them covering ash trees, but they would not deign to take a bite of that. But they love the oaks. And, of course, it becomes not just a landscape problem, but the gypsy moth has a lot of pubescence the caterpillar stage, all that hairiness that comes off, and people are quite allergic to it. And it gets into their respiratory tract and, on their skin. And so it is a big problem. And as people that experience gypsy moth, they see their huge numbers. They cover the house and cars and everything else. So there's every reason to try to, do as best we can in terms of managing and controlling. The life cycle of the gypsy moth is that it'll start out as a true moth. There's a male and a female moth. The male is sort of a drab brown color. The female doesn't fly very much. She's a white color. She'll hang on to the individual trees, find an appropriate spot, and then attract the male with the sexual pheromone. The male will come in, mate, fertilize those eggs, and the eggs will then hatch into the caterpillars the following spring. And the caterpillars will come on and start feeding. They'll grow over time. They will then pupate. They'll go through that miracle of metamorphosis, wrap themselves in a little cocoon structure, a pupa, and then emerge as these adult moths and fly around again later in the summer and conduct their process. It's only one generation of all of this happening. The key to dealing with insects that are pests that are damaging our plants, and not all insects are damaging. The vast majority are, you know, are either inconsequential or beneficial to the whole scheme of things. But these can be quite serious pests and damage trees and present health problems. The key is finding their vulnerable spots, their soft underbelly, so to speak. And the egg mass is one of those moments when they are particularly vulnerable. You can see those egg masses. They have kind of a yellowish color to them. They're very fibrous. They like to be stuck on the bottom side of the tree limbs or in the crevices. And it's not just on trees. They'll also go onto houses and soffits and whatever. You want to look around, and that's a moment when you can then put on a product called golden oil, which is actually a soybean oil. So it's perceived as a pesticide, but nonetheless, it suffocates it over winter. And so very important to do that. Having aerial spray by the state where it costs like $18 an acre as opposed to having people have individuals spray all the time is the right way to go.
Bruce Allison, our guest on this edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas. On this Arbor Day and on Garden Talk, we're visiting about trees with Bruce Allison, professional arborist, author of If Trees Could Talk from Wisconsin Historical Society Press. Glad to have him back. Give us a call with your questions at 800-642-1234. And the question came up about gypsy moths, and I know we talked about you've talked about the egg masses and oiling those egg masses. You also mentioned you've mentioned aerial spraying for gypsy moths, and I think that's also an important method to fight the gypsy moth.
Larry, it's a very important method, and I'm a strong believer in that whole concept of plant health care, integrated pest management, using all the tools we have in a biorational sense. The aerial spraying occurs during that period of vulnerability when the caterpillars have advanced enough and they start feeding. The material being sprayed by the planes is Bacillus thuringiensis caristaki, BTK, which is a naturally occurring soil fungus that gets into the gut of the insect and causes them to stop feeding. And that's why after you've had a successful spray program, you'll see all these caterpillar sort of hanging to the tree, dead, all shriveled up. And that means that the product has done. There's no evidence of phytotoxicity. These products have been around a long time. As it turns out, the EPA and the Food and Drug Administration allow the BTK to be used on organic broccoli in even, you know, a higher concentration than you're getting as you spray over. So I'm, you know, very sensitive to the people's concerns about use of pesticides in urban areas. I understand that. We've got some excellent laws in place. This is a voluntary program. It's not mandatory. So municipalities have to request it. There is good federal grant money that comes in to make it a very inexpensive way. And for homeowners that are dealing with gypsy moth, it is a great way to go because it's a low cost. It's controlled by the state. You have the aerial sprayers who are well-trained, following very specific rules. The concentrations and the mixing are under careful control, good documentation. I worry in a city setting about there not being that type of good controlled spraying with the right products and having individual tree companies come in and spray, shooting 60 feet up into a tree where you've got drift and so on, which, of course, by state law, you cannot have even one molecule of that pesticide drift onto somebody else's property. So it becomes much more problematic. That's why I'm a big proponent of the state program for suppression of gypsy moth using aerial spraying with this particular product.
Let's go to Rick in Poinette now. Rick, hello to you.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
If my trees could talk, they'd scream in agony.
Oh, no.
I have butternut trees. I had butternut trees from 8 inches in diameter to like 30 inches in diameter, 30 feet tall. And whatever disease they have, the outside gets real punky and the bark gets lumpy and they go from beautiful full trees down to one or two branches that'll actually have leaves on them in the second year of the infestation. So I've cut most of them down. There's a few that I've left, hoping that there'd be some miracle drug or something for them. But what I'm wondering is, what do I do with the logs? I hate to burn the stuff.
Yeah, I would like to see you not burn. I mean, if you have some mill-sized logs, you will discover that if you're able to get those milled, they make the most beautiful paneling, furniture, and it's become a rare tree. What you're dealing with is something called butternut decline. It has been a problem in the state for a long time. Butternut used to be a much more important forest product species. Butternut, of course, is sometimes called white walnut. It is in that juglone, just like black walnut genus. It was a wonderful tree. But this butternut decline is a fungus, again, with an associated pathogen that is able to cause cankers, just like that chestnut blight, on the woody tissue, and that's what you're describing. They will usually just be a spot that you will see on the bark. You'll see some seeping, kind of a darkened color, and then it becomes punky as it becomes larger, and again, severs those vascular cells, the xylem cells that are distributing the water and mineral nutrients up throughout that tree, and the tree goes into decline, and it is able to take out a lot of trees over time. There's just not many nice butternut groves left in the state. But if you have that possibility of taking those mill logs to some place or having them, you know, sometimes there's portable mill logs that can come and cut it up for you and then find a use in terms of furniture, paneling, something special, you will have just this most beautiful yellowish-colored wood, and it's gorgeous. Quite rare.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to find is a place to sell it. I really, I've milled some of it or had some boards cut a few years ago when the first ones went, but now I've got probably a dozen logs, and but I don't know. You know, I don't want somebody to come and say they're worth $3 a piece and they're worth $3,000.
Well, that's right. And so what you do, just like any other product you want to sell, you want to be able to get as many possible bidders as you possibly can, or, you know, any provider get different prices on what they would cost to do custom milling for you. The Department of Natural Resources, Bureau of Forestry, has a listing of all of those mills. And I think they also have a listing of the people that have portable mills. I mean, the Wood Miser is one. A lot of people have that now where they go to you and they can actually mill it there, and then you can do your own drying, or we'll purchase it if you're able to figure out some way to load it up on the back of a trailer and get it to them. But I would visit the Department of Natural Resources, Bureau of Forestry, see their listing. In your county, Rick, you're up in Poinette, I think you said. You'll find the county forester could be very helpful on that. Also, the Department of Forestry and Wildlife Ecology, Extension, will also have a listing of the different mills that will be able to be of help. Some might not be interested in purchasing butternut because it isn't much. There's not much of a market for it because there's just no little supply. But it would be more of a custom milling activity for you. But that's what I would do. I would definitely try to salvage it. I think you'd be very happy to have that on your own property over time if you could.
Thanks for calling, Rick. Appreciate it. John in Milwaukee, your turn now. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. I wanted to ask Bruce about a silver maple in my yard. One of the limbs is extending over my garage. It's probably 14, maybe 16 inches in diameter where it attaches to the tree, to the main part of the tree, and I want to cut it off. I hate to do it, but it's hanging over my garage, and it's causing some havoc there. So I was wondering, is this a good season to cut it? Should I wait for another season? And what should I do once I do make the cut as far as the open wound?
Well, good questions, I would wait a little bit longer. There's that brief period as the buds are starting to swell and open up that you have a lot of energy movement within that tree, and you might do well to wait until you have more leaf development before you make your pruning cut. I mean, quite candidly, you can prune almost any time of year on the majority of species with the exception of some of the disease-related issues. But I would just at this point wait a little bit longer. You'll discover that if you start cutting into maples or birch right now, you'll have a lot of sap movement coming out. But there's a lot of energy distribution going on, and you would probably get a better wound response if you waited a little bit longer. So wait another, 3 to 4 weeks, 5 weeks. I think you'd be fine. Just, even wait till midsummer if you choose to until you have, even more leaf development.
Sure.
But in terms of how to properly prune, that's a critical question. You want to make sure that you leave what's known as that branch bark collar. And that branch bark collar, as I might have mentioned before, is a collection of cells that have evolved over time at a lateral branch attachment either to another large branch or to the main trunk, as in your case. You'd like to leave those because those are cells that can rapidly grow, and divide and cause that callus tissue to form and close the wound, because that's the key to it, is closure. Complete the compartmentalization process and closure so the tree can grow beyond the wound that exists. And so what you want to do is find that little ridge that exists around the tree and carefully cut back to it only. And I strongly recommend that you get the from the Wisconsin Horticulture Extension Bulletin on how to properly prune deciduous trees. DNR also has one available, but it's really easy to access the one that Dr. Laura Jahl has put together on how to properly prune deciduous trees. And it's actually a diagram to show you. It's called target pruning, where you start on the top where you have what's known as the branch bark ridge, and that's one point. And then you drop a line down parallel to the trunk, and then another line perpendicular to the limb, which is going to be cut off. And then your cut is going to be bisecting that angle that's formed. And so you don't leave too much of a stub, but you're not cutting so far back that you take the branch bark collar away. And so that's important. One quick warning, make sure that you don't make that your first cut. Make sure that you're reducing the weight and you keep on undercutting, top cutting, drop that weight off so that the weight of that remaining last branch doesn't cause a ripping along the main trunk. That is a common problem in pruning. You don't want to have that because that makes a much bigger wound, breaks through that branch bark collar, and is to be avoided. And John, I hope that helps.
Yeah, thank you.
Could I just say one more thing?
Sure.
The branch looks like it's trying to reach for some sunshine because it's so shady back there. There's so many trees. Would that hurt it? It looks, by cutting it back, I was afraid it might inhibit the absorption of the sunshine by the tree. Probably not, but I was just wondering briefly if you think that.
Yeah, good question. And, typically you would not want to take off any more than 20% of the crown at one pruning. And so you've got to be, quite cautious there. I mean, 15 to 20% is usually the standard that you want to arrive at. You don't want to shock that tree by taking so much of its area of photosynthesis away that it can't produce a normal amount of carbohydrates, because that's what is the money of a tree, is the carbohydrates. They want to produce it, and then they use it over time. Lower branches particularly, and I suspect by your description of it sort of reaching out for sunlight, it probably is in a lower position. Lower branches are going to be less of a problem because they're already somewhat stressed. There is a theory called the autonomous limb theory that says that each limb in that tree has to produce its own carbohydrates, and then, if you will, tithe the main part of the tree, to make sure that those parts that are not able to conduct photosynthesis, the trunk, the roots, other areas are going to be able to have enough carbohydrates. So by taking off a lower limb that already is somewhat under stress and is not that big of a contributor to the tree is less problematic than going up in the upper crown where you have a very successful, fully exposed to the sun branch that's producing tons of carbohydrates and sending its share back down to the tree. So I think it will not be a problem. Sometimes if you take off too much of the upper crown, you can produce sun scald problems, parts of the bark that had not been exposed to sunlight then suddenly are. You've got to be careful not to do that. But by your description, that lower branch sounds like if it's properly pruned off would have no adverse effect upon the tree. Do not put tree wound dressing on. You do have a large wound there, and the one thing about silver maples is they're not as efficient at dealing with decay as some other species might be, so you might indeed have a cavity there over time. But if your decision has been that you've got a problematic limb that you need to take off, then you just go ahead and do it.
Just do it.
But don't put tree paint on. We now know that there is no benefit to do so. In fact, you create an environment somewhat more conducive to decay by taking away the things that slow fungus, which we know, which are air circulation and sunlight.
And thank you very much for calling. And Jackie in Milwaukee will give you a chance now. Hi, Jackie.
Good morning. Congratulations, Larry.
Thank you.
I've got three, I think they qualify as trees, three dwarf Japanese maple
okay.
trees.
They certainly qualify as trees. That's, and you're very lucky. They sound like they're a nice addition to your landscape.
Well, they will be, but I've got a couple of questions. Number one, it says protect them from sweeping winds. I live in Milwaukee. We get a lot of sweeping winds. Would it be good if I have them in the ground to put up a kind of a burlap protection in winter?
Yeah, you could do that. Maybe the placement of them, not with northwest exposure, which is probably going to be the most problematic type of wind. I mean, we certainly get some southern winds too, but they're not going to come at a time of year when the tree is going to be more vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe not locate directly in the northwest. And if you have other plants around them that might break that wind,
okay.
I mean, the U.S. Forest Service and USDA for many years after the dust bowls of the 1930s and whatever put a lot of money into putting up shelter trees on farms because we know that as the wind velocity picks up and the wind is moving horizontally through, it then is lifted over the crowns of those trees. Trees are very aerodynamic, and the wind is then diverted away from the house and away from your tree. So if there's something maybe more to the northwest or to the northerly direction so as to allow a more protected still soils, still winds, that was probably a pretty good idea. If you don't have that luxury, then yes, putting up some comparable, man-made barrier would be fine too.
The other thing is in the directions at the bottom they casually put in, they may be grown in pots and they're excellent tub plants. Now, when they talk about that, which is what I'd like to use two of them for, are they talking half barrel? Or what are they talking about? Because the instructions say 12 inches wide, 12 inches deep, the hole should be, and the plant should be in only an inch from where the ground was before.
Yeah.
Now,
The bigger the pot in which you were going to grow them, the more successful the plants will be. If you imagine full size of those dwarf Japanese maple what did they give instructions there? Is that going to be 8 feet tall, feet tall?
No, 12 to 20 inches.
Oh, 12 to 20 inches.
Yeah.
Oh, very, very small.
Dwarf. Oh.
They're very dwarf.
Eh? Oh, they're almost like a bonsai there. Okay.
Yeah, that's really, that's.
Yeah. Well, and then, since I would use that the same kind of formula that if you've got, 12 inches tall, you would like to have maybe, twice that width for a pot. So if you had a 24-inch to 36-inch pot, that would give it some pretty good growth. That's very small, so that's super dwarf. It's not semi-dwarf.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's why I wonder if they would qualify as a tree.
Yeah, well,
they look more shrubby, but but they're the color in the and the place where I used to have what is the tree that turns red in fall? It was too shaded by a hawthorn and the birch, mm-hmm. and now most of those branches have been cut off from them. So I think that where I would be putting them, there would be enough sun that the color would change.
Well, good. And you certainly need that sunlight to develop that pigment called anthocyanin, which is the reddish pigment that you get later in the year. It's a combination of the right temperature conditions combined with an adequate amount of sunlight to have that transformation of the pigment into anthocyanin, which is a type of sugar.
Thank you very much for calling, Jackie. Appreciate it. Bonnie in Sturgeon Bay emailed us a black walnut tree. They took it out last summer. It was very close to the vegetable garden. She realizes that it produced juglan, which inhibited or even prohibited the growth of some of her vegetables. Wondering how long that root will continue affecting the garden once you've cut that tree down. It's going to last for quite a long time, if I'm not mistaken.
It will, exactly. And, yeah, Bonnie, there's probably not much you can do about that. It probably wouldn't be a bad idea if you've got the possibility of, you know, routing that remaining root system out mm-hmm. as much as you can. Although you're going to discover that most of that juglone is going to have been produced at the, you know, tips, the growing yeah. tips of those roots. But nonetheless, mm-hmm. if you can get rid of, you know, as much of the wood as you can, and then perhaps, you know, once it's out, replace it with other soils in there. And as far as I know, there is no antidote per se, nothing that you can put into that soil that will counter mm-hmm. that allelopathic effect of that juglones in the soil. And on the other hand, you have to admire that doggone tree for having come up with such a clever idea to make sure that all of its other tree brethren could not slip into its particular niche.
And Bruce, someone emailed, are you signing? You got some book signings coming up for your book, If Trees Could Talk?
I would encourage that person, if they're interested in seeing some of the presentations I'll be making, and they've done a good job at the Wisconsin State Historical Society Press. In fact, I'm not sure. I wish I could clone myself. But go to the university, go to the Wisconsin Historical Society Press website, and there will be a link that will talk about the author's schedules. And if you do that, you will see where I might be in your area. And I've done, you know, quite a bit of, you know, movement around so far, and they've done a good job of getting out, which I'm delighted for
yeah.
because, I mean, I feel so motivated as I mature and my kids are you know, mm-hmm. grown and almost out of college to see the importance of young people having an affection and love for trees, which I know you share, Larry.
Yes.
And you got the message already that I guess I like what I'm doing.
Bruce, it is always a pleasure. I'm sorry. We've got a whole pile of emails and every line filled, but we'll have you back and certainly we'll talk about trees again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bruce Allison, professional arborist and author of If Trees Could Talk from Wisconsin Historical Society Press. I hope you have a chance to look at it. It's a wonderful book and aimed at that kind of fourth, fifth grade age level. But frankly, it's something that any of us are going to enjoy. I can tell you that for sure. Well, taking a look ahead at what's in store for us on Monday, we'll be taking a look at airfare bargains and how to search for those. Rick Sini of faircompare.com will be our guest at 11 o'clock. And then at 11:45, must be the last Monday of the month because our weather guys are coming by. Professor Steve Ackerman and John Martin put our weather in perspective. Thanks for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.